So we are teaching AI to play Zork. Zork is a game from the 80s. We're letting it run around. Maybe we build it an MCP and we like it's doing things. How do we know what it's up to? Like, we need views, high-level views, right? Something keeping track of what's going on. And it feels extremely applicable to code. Because in code, like, what happened, right? What is the current goal that we're trying to do? It feels like we need those kind of summarizers to be able to keep up with it.
I'm Ken Rimple.
And I'm Jessica Kerr.
You're listening to Observability Cast, a monthly series where we talk about how we can make production systems more observable, more reliable, and easier to maintain. Olicast is brought to you by HeavyBit, the leading investor in developer-first startups. For more information, visit heavybit.com.
How do you know what your coding assistant is doing?
Right. And when, right? Because I think there's a lot of things related to that. One of the things is like, what is it in its head? Like, you tell it things and you're like, did it understand me? Or did it read it? Because agentic systems can pull in things in the context. So I think the thing you were thinking about is the little emojis that I've not done.
That's one of them. But let's start with what you were just saying about when you're using a coding assistant, there's like lots of levels or ways to think about what the hell is it doing. Can you describe some of those?
Right. So first of all, what's in its head, right? We're dealing with a black box. And the black box is very silent and mysterious. So really, like, first of all, the code, you can open it up and you're like, oh, I understand this, right? It takes some skill, but it's doable. With AI, not so much. Plus, it's like a little bit of mental model going on there that's really hard to see what's inside. Plus, its context is also invisible, right? So it read some stuff. You don't necessarily know what it's read because it's also kind of pulling things in. So that's one aspect, right? What's going on inside that mysterious black box? Another thing is, like, what is it doing really? Like, what is it physically doing currently? Like, what did it call some tools? Did it look at this file? Did it look at that file? Did it miss anything? And then the big thing that I see a lot is, like, it is very noisy and it is very fast. And that kind of creates a problem of how do we keep up with this crazy noisy token machine, right?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a silent black box and yet it's not silent. It's very verbose.
Right. It's silent in some ways, but very not silent in some ways. And all of that is tricky. So I have this like idea of how you can zoom in and out when you need. And look, you need a kind of a level of noise suppression, first and foremost, right? You need to not let it overwhelm, because I see so many people just allowing it to spam them, asking them 10 questions and they literally sit down and answer every question.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I hate that. I'm like, no, one question at a time.
Yes, exactly. Like, that's the core rule that should be everywhere. So that's one. And then, like, in documents, right? If you let it spam in documents, basically it starts reading pieces of documents and then chomping it up, and like there's dead parts of documents. So it read this part but didn't update that part, and like it gets messy so quickly.
Yeah.
So same thing. Like, you can zoom out and be like high level, and then whoa, suddenly you could see.
How do you do that? Do you tell us something?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was interesting because like I started doing this before it was a thing, I think, because I saw it first in tools in June when I saw Claude Code. When you do like init in Claude Code, it does create the Claude MD. And with the like old models, especially, it created a beautiful thing. It was so like so good because it's like, okay, here's the parts of the documents or like this repo that's important. Here's our things, do this, don't do that. Very high level, super like the gist of the gists. And it's super scannable. And I kind of started doing it maybe back in April because my documents started rotting. My documents started, like, you start doing kind of spec-driven, or I'm not sure if it's spec-driven, but I do put things in files a lot. I have this knowledge documents, ground rules, and so on. And as you start to progress your system, this grows. And then how do you keep it up with code, right?
That's true. And like, we have these AI assistants who are really fast at updating documentations. So we have the potential to keep our documentation up, but we also used it to create a much higher volume of documentation, and it doesn't actually go back and update at all.
Yeah.
And your cognitive load is like high trying to get through all that stuff, because if you let it do its thing for a while, guilty. You end up with so much to go through. And Jess has warned me about this, and she's been right every time. It's like, delete those stupid files it generated. Because yes. It's like, it's doing like a fridge poetry version of that in the context and saying, maybe this. And you're like, is it? What are you doing?
Absolutely.
Right?
I'm so with you. Absolutely. Like, delete mercilessly. That's one of the things you do. And it's like, it's hard because people have this attachment to written documentation, especially written stuff by not them. It's really hard. Like, because like, don't you see it all the time? Like, in code. Like,
so we'll delete what we wrote.
Yeah, we will delete what we wrote most of the time. Although, like, many people don't embrace Git still as they should.
Yeah. It's there. You can go back to it.
I wrote it, right? So you can get past it. But if it's somebody else, if they're in the project, that gets really bad.
Yeah.
And like, imagine five of those with very noisy agents in one project.
Oh, okay.
It is not sustainable.
So how do you know what's safe to delete?
Basically, just my default mode is super zoomed out. So high level, like whenever I go, it's like, most of the things, please, high level. I have ground rules. So this is like the rules that are always in the context.
And you keep those really up to date.
Those are absolutely up to date. I have like 75 lines and I know every one of those.
Oh, okay. Nice. Got it.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
But I have a rule of in that one of those lines is be extremely succinct.
Be extremely succinct. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So high level, short, like when I go ask questions in the repo, like I open a new repo and I try to poke at it. I'm like, give me architecture on a high level. And it's so good at that because you can zoom out and you can see, you know, suddenly on high level. Then you can poke in and you can zoom in. So like we have this semantic zoom now that is like a lens that allows us to go in and in and out.
In language.
In language and in code, in anything, any text. And then you can zoom in by asking more questions, especially if there's more context there, right? So in repo, like it can actually go far deeper because there's depth there. In a document that's just written on one level of abstraction, you don't have that. So you'd have it to either guess or pull in stuff that doesn't exist, right? So yeah, and I use this all the time and it's super, super helpful. And I think this is something like I still find ways to use it. Like I think I'm progressing to level two because you can also do it in tests.
Oh.
Because if you think about, like you're trying to keep up with AI and it writes a lot of code and writes a lot of tests. How do you know what it did if you're not looking very closely? One way is like to write tests on the level, on high level abstraction. So you can do it several ways again. You do approval tests, right? Zoom out. And approval tests can be images or it can be structured text in a way that's super scannable. That's one of them at least. And then you can also do like custom assertions and all of that, right? So make it easy for yourself to follow the agent by zooming out.
So it looks like BDD, like behavior-driven design tests.
I think BDD are super powerful and you want them on the level outside the agent is what I can't come into. Like the agent shouldn't touch them.
Oh, okay.
On some stage.
But in BDD, you like say, given condition in natural language, when something happens in natural language, then expectation in natural language. And the hard part of BDD historically has been implementing all those steps because you kind of hard code, okay, when I say, then the cart should be empty. Here's the code version of that. But the agent can implement those steps, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and you can go Gherkin if you'd like you're describing. You can also do approval tests. So like me and Llewellyn Falco have a talk about better testing with approval tests.
And approval tests, that's where you have like a snapshot, right?
Yeah, it's like a golden standard, right? So you basically, it produces something. You're like, yes, it looks good to me. Check mark. And then now it's a golden start. And whenever you run the tests, if it produces that, we don't even say anything. We say everything is good. And if it's bad, it shows the diff. So now it's immediately, quickly, you can see what's wrong.
Yeah, if it's different. Or sometimes I want it to make a change and I'm using those approval tests to confirm to myself that it made the change I wanted.
And to be clear here, these tests, you write them. You write the test. You don't let the LLM generate the tests.
With approval tests.
Well, I'm saying like the specs, so to speak.
Okay.
What I'm saying is like, let's take the BDD side of things, right? You would want to assert everything in the given when then language. You want to think at a high enough level so that you can understand what it's trying to test. So that when it goes crazy ham on your code and breaks the test, you could say, hey, rebuild these based on this same specification I gave you earlier because you screwed up and it's not running and I want you to fix what you did and I understand at a high level of abstraction. So now do what I want to do at a high level of abstraction, right? Is that basically what you're saying? Sorta?
Sort of. So again, Luan Falco. So he has a very, very good way to do this with, this is how he approaches TDD. He's like, here's a feature. Write me first all the tests, single lines of English. Every test is a single line of English, no more than that. And I think that forces it to get the... So this is where you zoomed out to the level that you get the gist of the stuff that you care about. And it's very scannable, extremely scannable. I can quickly see the list and be like, did it miss something? The next thing I would do immediately is like, look at this level of tests, look at the task, and look what you just produced. Double check yourself. Did you miss something? Find issues with that. This is like a pattern I use. It's called, I call it feedback flip. It's basically like immediate feedback from the agent. Surprisingly works with the same agent, which kind of blows my mind. And I'm like, why? And I think I have ideas, but it's interesting.
So Lada, tell us who you are and how you got to know so much about AI-assisted coding.
Yeah. So I'm a software developer. I would call myself probably a crafter. So I love extreme programming. I love TDD refactoring and like have been tending for legacy code for a while. But I also like writing good stuff from scratch very much. Probably my preference. We don't always get to do that, right? And so this year I've been skeptical about AI for like maybe a year and a half ago, pretty skeptical because it didn't seem very useful. But suddenly I found myself on a project where I didn't have any front-end developers. And I was like, can I do this with AI in the thing that I don't know, Angular? And I kind of did. And then it was like, I was like, okay, now I'm paying attention. So I've been exploring it since because like, I think like people say hype, not hype, but like my last year is not anything like the previous 15 years in this career. So yeah, I'm exploring it like mad. And I was just super curious. It's just super interesting. And I'm trying to understand what we're dealing with. And also how do we like, I guess because Crafter and XV and all that, I kind of care deeply about how to do good things with it, how to do this well, especially like how to produce software that lasts and doesn't break on us and cause issues and breaks trust of our customers.
So did you, my ears perked up because it's front end that you're generating. And because that's always a complex beast. Like everyone says that, you know, oh, front end development's easy until they do it. And then you realize it's a moving sludge pile of crazy numbers of APIs that change before you sit down the next morning for coffee. You're like, why is this thing broken?
Sounds like AI. Yeah, perfect.
Right? It's yeah, they fit together like ice cream and something else. something I won't say, yes. Anyway, so what were your first halting steps in getting this black box to give you something that you could use? And like, when did you do the aha moment? Okay, oh, wait a second, now I'm productive with this.
Yeah, so that was that moment that basically changed my mind about AI, right? So I was basically doing a backend for, I was writing an agent. Now I figured out how to do RAG and how to do the backend part of what I needed to do. And then suddenly I have no front end. What do I do? And this was pre-agentic. That was in November. Agentic barely started. So last year.
November of 2024.
Yeah, November of 2024. And I was a bit late to the party. There was a, so Anthropic had a feature that they released earlier that's called projects. And the difference between the browser and the projects is you can upload files there. So you can have like a little folder with context that you upload. And if you combine it with a tool that allows you to grab a piece of code and just concatenate it into a giant string, you basically have a way to quickly give your agent in the browser, which is still locked in the browser, right? All your context or a big chunk of your project. And then suddenly that agent that was really, really useless before can tell you how to add an Angular page. And I'm doing things step by step always, very slowly. So I'm like, can you create me an empty Angular page? And it does. And I look at the code and I have to paste it still, right? So it's pretty agentic. So I have to kind of grab the code and paste it, but it works. And then like, can you add a thing here to this? Can you add a text to this thing? And so on. And I build the whole thing. And like, I got compliments for my design skills.
It's doing something right.
Yeah. And that's not the first one. Yeah. Since then, I've been pretty much agnostic of the technical stack. And it's crazy.
Yeah, because you could do React, you could do Vue, you could do... I've just done two mobile apps, an iOS and Android with it. And I'm like, darn, now Claude and I are mobile developers suddenly, but we can get things done.
Precisely.
And sometimes the best design is following patterns.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it's good at that.
It's really good at that.
And because we know how to write software well, you can still guide an agent, right? So I find that all my skills that I built before, like if I get myself into something unpleasant, I can get myself out and I know when to start. So, you know, like the hilarious moments where agents, some people show screenshots of what they do their agents and they get the agents so desperate that they delete themselves from their computers.
I guess it's better than kicking puppies.
They must be bad bosses in real life, right? Like, I would think that, like, if you're that mean to an LLM, okay, it's not real, but oh boy.
You don't even need to be mean to LLM. The only thing you need to do is vibe code and continue vibe coding. It will just do it for you.
That's true.
Oh, because they get ashamed of themselves.
They basically are like running into the same problem as like a group of completely clueless developers who don't know how to do anything good in code other than just produce code. Right? They don't have design skills, testing skills, all of that. They don't know when to apply it. Imagine that at speed. And that's where the agent arrives.
Yes. And get in this loop, by the way. I find that I get in this circular loop with then when that happens where you know it's time to give up and nuke things and start again. When every question you ask it, when it's screwing up, it gives you a version of what it did wrong last time that it thinks you forgot about. You're like, no, I've seen this before 3 questions ago and you did it 6 questions ago yeah. And we're in a loop and I quit. We're done.
Actually, that's actually a pattern that Yvette Ordog added. That's absolutely a thing that you can think about as a good marker of start again. You're in the corner.
Yeah.
Right. And the way to start again easier, like you will save yourself a lot of brain cells if you actually have like safe points in between, right? Don't just like do a giant, write me a Twitter. That's a recipe for disaster. At some point, you're going to run into a wall. That's a guarantee. But like if you do like, okay, write me a page, then do this. And you save the all the stuff in the files. So like you save the intermediate, what you ask it to do. And then it makes you so powerful because you can also spin 5 of them and do it in parallel.
You mean save the instructions,
Save
the plan,
yeah.
Not just smart. Obviously the code is in files.
Yeah, that's
right.
So like, here's a feature file. This is what we're trying to implement. Here's a to-do. Like we have a group of files. Now, because they're saved and there's a save point after that, so you commit it, right? Now you can, first of all, start so easily. And so I call it knowledge checkpoint. You have a knowledge checkpoint. You save the piece. Instead of going and telling AI, which is basically a like a fleeting context that closes and is rotting in front of you so quickly, you saved it, and now you can reuse it, so you can start a different context at this like immediately. And you can also parallelize it, like you can do like 10 agents that do the same thing and try it out. And you can steal features from different branches, so it's kind of mad.
Nice. So you have a collection of these patterns, right?
Yeah, I do.
Tell us more.
So the idea was basically very simple. Somebody asked me how I code with AI, and I was starting thinking about it, and it was so hard to get this, to communicate this to anyone. And everybody I've talked to, so every developer who is really, really good at agentic coding is like, I don't know how to communicate this thing. I have so many intuitions, but like, I just stare at my computer and agent does a lot of things. And where do you start? So my goal was to do a talk, because Jacqueline Lee from Calgary Software Crafters asked me to do a talk. And I started thinking about it. My goal was to teach somebody the things that I learned this year, exploring like crazy. And as we distilled the idea, so Jacqueline helped me, Llewellyn Falco helped me a lot with figuring out what is even in my head. They were like, oh, you have patterns in your head. You have very many little things. They kind of build on each other. And they're bite-sized, each of them, but together they can be combined and you can like arrange them and think through them. And now you have I basically have a talk that has a walkthrough of these patterns.
Oh, that's really cool.
And a repo,
yeah. Thanks to Yvette also. Yvette helped to make the website because I just wrote them as Markdown and she was like, oh no, we should make it a website.
It's github.com/Lexler, LEXLER. /augmented coding patterns, right?
Yeah, with dashes in between.
Yes.
There's also lexlangithub.io augmented coding patterns. So it's a bit, yeah, thank you for finding it.
And we will put that link in the show notes.
Yeah, for sure.
Some of these patterns help you know what the agent is doing, right? Like this one that tells you what files it's been reading in. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so I call it context marker. And the idea is basically, or whenever you try to figure out what is in the context, you can make it a little bit more visible by just adding a few things. So I have a ground rule. So this is like in my blog.d file that says basically always start replies to me with a starter emoji, right? And the starter emoji is like formed as a variable, starter underscore emoji. And my starter emoji is a, I don't know, lucky clover this time of year. And then I can do basically in the process file.
What's the process file?
Right. So if you're not unfamiliar with process files, you probably want to listen to Llewellyn Falco's talk on process files, which we should also link. The process file is basically, you can think about it as code, as text. So or text as code, it's hard to say which one. So basically it's a file that describes how an agent can do something, right? For example, here's my TDD process. It's a process file. When you start TDDing, write me tests as English, high-level English, and show it to me. Then one by one, start with implementing each test, make sure that this and that and so on.
Oh, so it's almost like a system prompt for a particular circumstance.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, exactly. Or like a task. Yeah, and it often follows the steps. So it kind of is a little bit more deterministic because it's basically a to-do, and to-dos are magical with AI because I think they focus them and allow them to do things in steps.
Okay, so you've got your starter emoji, and whenever it talks to you, it shows you that, right?
Yes.
I've started using this mine as a carrot.
A carrot, that's hilarious. Like
the stick is right behind you.
Because that's like a carrot. Carrot.
Oh. I love it. Can I see it sometime?
That's why you do that.
All right. So there's that. And then you can basically like, in my TDD process, I'm like, when you're in red phase or green phase, like I have a little like green plant that it shows me. So I'm green. Mm-hmm. And then in red, there's a circle or like a no thing. And then in a refactor, there's like a loop thing. And I see immediately which phase of TDD it's in, right?
Oh, so this is making its verbose output scannable.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Very quickly.
That's a great idea.
Oh, thank you. And then there's things, so what else do I use it? Like I sometimes put markers in individual instructions. For example, I have an instruction of my agent needs to be proactive and warn me if I'm about to mess up or if there's something wrong. And I ask it to also display an exclamation point emoji in there so I see quickly. So when I see that emoji, I know that instruction fired, right? And that's good to know because it's really good to know. Like when you have a CloudMD file for your agent, right, a ground rules. If those ground rules are not followed, they're noise. And the problem with noise with AI is it's not just noise, it's also harmful because it takes focus away from the agent. So it's making you less efficient, right? So that's one of the ways. Another way to use this kind of thing is like, I think you saw my Chewbacca, Jessica. So somebody was saying that they split up their giant CloudMD because apparently there's a limit to how much how big you could make it. And they split it into a bunch of files and they're like, oh, now they're always lazy loaded. And I know that they might not be because I've kind of tested before. So I'm like, they need tests. And here's how you can test. You can go. So the main CloudMD is pointing to, say, a file that's called MapMD. Did the agent read that MapMD when you opened the new window? Right? You put a thing, something like, say Chewbacca when you see this, when you read this. And you open the thing. You open the window and you see Chewbacca. Guess what? It's not lazy loaded, right? So this like a little tricks help us build intuitions.
Oh, so that's the part where you don't want it to read all those files when it first starts up. You just want it to have access to them later. And it is.
Precisely. But it's mighty good to know how it's working for real underneath, right?
Yes.
So now you can, maybe you can out prompt this. Maybe now you can be like, don't read it now. Read it when you need it and see immediately, did it work?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
This is a kind of live observability of like in human joint activity, you want to be sure you have enough common ground, which is, I know that you know this and you know that I know this. And that common ground is established by like these files that you've actually curated and they're up to date. And the pattern of starter emoji and say this when you read this file gives you an awareness of what that AI knows, of what knowledge you do have in common or don't.
Yeah.
And that increases the interpredictability, well, at least your predictability of it, which helps with the joint activity.
Yeah, I think so. So the idea of like putting a word there was, this is where I kind of got the idea initially, right? So somebody was like, call me this name when you read this at the ground rules. And I thought that name wasn't, so I immediately made a funny name. It was funny for the first 5 minutes and then it got really annoying. And then I'm like, instead, I want to see emojis. And emojis are nice because now you can have emoji per file. So I can also stack my emojis. So the way I do this is like my golden standard rules of like how to, I don't know, write like how to do hexagonal architecture is a hexagon emoji, for example. And now I see my ground rules with a clover and then a hexagon. Now it's, I know that it read both. There's a difference how different agents handle contexts and sometimes what happens when the context gets too long, right? So for Windsurf, for example, I had like three emojis in there. And when I saw one of them disappear, I'm like, okay, this part got out of the context and I can see it immediately because it's just not there in the three things and it's so scannable.
Oh, that's great. So you can see stuff, enter the context, and leave it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it forgot about this because it's not showing me a tree.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not 100%, but if you don't see it, it's definitely not there. Right. If it sees it, there's also a question, does it pay attention to it?
Right.
It's not the same thing.
Right.
Because it may not have enough focus.
Ken, what were you going to say?
I'm just like blown over. I really love that I have a new site I'm going to spend a lot of time on because I am in that early journeyman putting the tools on the table and going, I wish I had this screwdriver, you know, mode of Claude and making lots of dumb mistakes. And I feel like just like when patterns came out for coding, it was a great thing to reference to start realizing there's predictable ways of doing things that you can use and take advantage of. So I love this. I'm just thrilled.
I'm also trying to be like, how do we do it in a way that's not fleeting? And I'm starting from the problems. So I'm starting to think, what is this thing in front of us? I try to understand it and like, so there's things about it that are important. So like that black box that I described, right? And the fact that it's biased to be compliant. But also there's like the fact that it can't learn, right? So now we have to build the context for it because it can't learn and we need to restart. The only thing we can do is restart or add to it.
That's a great point.
Or it learns really fast all at once at the beginning when it starts the conversation and then promptly forgets it. At the end. Well, except it doesn't even forget it. You just start it over and it's a new person.
Yeah, yeah. Because, and that's another problem.
Yeah.
Exactly. But that problem is actually a limited focus, right? So what you described is basically you told it so much that you overloaded it and it doesn't work well. And this is very interesting because I saw really good and some people I think haven't seen really good. So when you focus the agent, and so I had this proactivity rules.
Oh, like you've seen it do really well?
Yes, yes. And this is on narrow focus. So narrow, very focused agent that only does one thing is magical. And like I only saw it because I basically had a main clock code with a code with everything. And then I had a little committer. And they all have one block of rules, basically ground rules that they reference. And they had those proactivity rules in there. Warn me if there's any issues. Tell me if I'm about to make a mistake. Don't push back against problems. And so on. Like, you know, ask questions, all of that, right? And my main agent, like I was waiting for this to hit and it never did. But suddenly my committer started doing that. And I almost dropped out of Chiro I saw it the first time. It was seriously, because it's like suddenly Lada.
How did you know it was the committer? Does it have its own starter emoji?
No, no, no. My world looks like this. I have basically right now a terminal. I used to be on iTerm 2 for a while. Now it's Ghosty. And basically it's just blocks of windows I've opened there, right? So I have Claude code. That's my main Claude code on the left. And there's just a piece of screen is that. But then another piece of screen, usually a smaller one, is a committer. So I open two Claude codes in the terminal, at least, mm-hmm. right? And the committer, the only thing I do in this committer window, it has its own instructions. Like, you're a committer, only commit, do this, do that.
Okay, so it's not a sub-agent. It's that you are giving a different agent an instruction here.
Different agent.
Okay.
In the same repo.
Single purpose.
Single purpose.
Right.
Yeah. And suddenly that single purpose one started to notify me about things. It's like, you're about to commit this node modules. Did you mean to do that?
Nice.
And seriously, this was so surprising. And because I have those productivity rules and because I didn't overload it and do this, that, and thing, like some people are like, agents have so much focus, like 7,000 plus minus two or something. I think it's not the case, actually. I think it's still 7 plus, not plus minus two.
Nice.
Yeah. So this is an example. Limited focus is an example of another kind of blocker that is really good to know. Then you can actually do something about it.
So one of the things that I keep running into, because I don't do these things the way you're doing them, is that working with the AI to get things done is such a variable box. It could take 2 hours or 3 weeks.
Absolutely.
But you're giving it these little targeted prompts that say, because you're a committer or because you're working on page design, you will know everything about, like, focus on CSS and on whatever my style stuff is, but don't focus on the serious code. Focus on the UI layout.
Yeah.
And you're narrowing the black box's purview, its reach.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's really brilliant. Yep.
I think you have to, like, because, like, so this thing cannot manage complexity, or it doesn't manage complexity now. I don't know. We may need to just build a better tool, but so you have to, naturally. Like, if you don't manage complexity, nothing will. And then complexity will grow and kill you, because it kills you very quickly. You know how quickly you can code yourself into a corner, mm-hmm. even as one developer without AI.
I'm good at that too. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so am I.
But that makes a lot of sense. So one of the things I was thinking about when I'm hearing this is there was this book many years ago called Refactoring Your Wetware. It was by Annie Hunt. So his whole point was, your cerebral cortex can't keep everything in memory. So you externalize it by putting in things in mind maps and other things to kind of like have an external cortex. The LLMs is you're basically giving it an external cortex to work with. So when it dies, the next weird thing that comes back can look at that same cortex and catch up.
Because it dies as soon as its context gets overloaded and it starts being annoying and you get in that loop and you say slash clear. And that one's dead, and then you hire another one, and then it reads all the documentation, and bam, it's ready to go.
And let me finish that too, because I mean, yes, the problem I have is when I'm doing an investigation about something, oh, this ticks me off so much. I'm doing an investigation about something really complex, and I have a certain amount of knowledge that's amassed to help me solve the problem, but it starts running out of context, and I'm like, so if I kill it, it loses that unless I tell it, spend some time, write this out, which I do.
Yes.
Spend some time, write out what you've learned so far. I haven't gotten the mechanics right to like this. Please, you know, do that, but be focused.
What you described just now was like a pattern that I have as well. It's called, can I extract knowledge? Mm-hmm. So you put a lot of energy into this context that is fleeting and ephemeral. Immediately, as you did, basically get it out into a file, into a safe space. Now you have a thing you can point at, and it's going to take you a second versus a reiteration of the same thing.
Yeah.
That piece of knowledge is going to get out of date.
It might, yeah, it might. So you kind of need to figure out how to keep it up, and the way you keep it up.
Or delete it.
Oh, delete it. Oh, God, yes. Delete it, please.
Especially with something during refactoring that doesn't matter anymore. Get rid of it.
And thing is, like with AI, the dead stuff is out there to get you because, so the agent finds it. It's like, oh, I found the place where, like in code, right? I found the page that you're trying to fix. Let me fix everything about it. And this is one of the ways it gets itself in the loop. I've been there. Like dead code is deadly. It's deadlier mm-hmm. with AI.
Oh, because that anything incorrect or out of date in the context is not only spending focus on something useless, but it's actively directing it towards something wrong.
It's a text-based foot gun. Yeah. It is different than the last 30-some years of coding for me, too. It's a totally different world. You're absolutely right.
Kind of crazy, yeah.
See, I just did the AI thing, too. I just told you were absolutely right.
Oh, no. It's entering our lexicon.
I need therapy, seriously.
We need, like, some sort of reverse therapy where someone tells us we're wrong.
Whenever you say that, Claude, say I'm absolutely wrong. Yeah, that'd be great.
That's pretty easy to do as a hook, actually, I think.
Oh, as a hook. Yeah. Tell me when I'm wrong. No, tell me more.
Yeah, just yesterday I was like thinking about like, I noticed not telling my Claude that it's right. And now then I'm like, no.
So here's my question for both of you. How have you complained to Claude when it's done something wrong to you and you want to fix it?
Slash clear.
Yeah, you just quit right away without trying to get it to fix itself, right?
It's like, we're out, yeah.
Because I've actually said, no, which is stupid. And it just leads you down the path if it gets worse from here.
Because that wrong stuff that it said is in its context.
Yes, it's in memory now, and it's just going to hurt you further.
Yeah, I guess I sometimes escape and roll back, pretend it doesn't exist and roll the dice again.
Escape, do you like back up the conversation?
Mm-hmm. So I go to previous message, basically.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
I've heard of people who like go in and edit its own thinking.
No way. I guess you can write a tool like that pretty easily, yeah.
Lotta, you were talking about the little starter emojis and stuff like that give you an immediate connection to what is it doing right now, but that's not persistent. Kind of on the other end of that, when you hook up OpenTelemetry to Claude Code, for instance, it will output like logs and metrics about what it's doing to, well, I send it to Honeycomb, of course. Mm-hmm. And those are persistent and it's really useful for like, I don't know, how much was I spending? But it doesn't have the full level of detail and it doesn't have a trace.
You're right.
It doesn't like walk you through a conversation. What did it do?
Mm-hmm.
So I leave that on, but yeah, it doesn't help me while I'm, it doesn't, the OpenTelemetry output doesn't help me use it better so far anyway.
Yeah. It's very entertaining though, like especially when you, like when I started coding with Claude Code, my friend also has a, he created a dashboard in Honeycomb.
Nice.
And then we've been like, oh, look at how much usage we had. Like, yeah, it was just fun. And also like, oh, there is the new model. We knew immediately.
Ah, right. Which model it used.
Yeah. And cost also, yeah.
True. I was going to ask you what you were wondering about when you said something about how could you make this knowledge of what it's doing less ephemeral.
Right. I think this is where I think we need a tool. Like I'm about to write something like that on my own, I think, because it feels like we need something observing what it's doing. So like a thing that keeps maybe another LLM that keeps just everything, what's going on. And then you give it tasks and it abstracts, kind of zooms out and maybe saves it somewhere. So I almost want like a high level, here's what's going on in this stage. I can give you an example. It's not code related. It's weird.
Great.
Yeah. So me and Peter Koffler are doing something kind of crazy. So we are teaching AI to play Zork. Zork is a game from the 80s.
Oh yeah. Microsoft just open sourced it, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Cool. You saw it. So we're like, what does it even mean? Right. So here we're approaching something like, what does it mean for us? So we're trying lots of crazy different things. And one of the things we meet, like what we saw is like, okay, we're letting it run around. Maybe we built it in MCP and we like it's doing things. How do we know what it's up to, right? First thing, like, it would be nice to have a map, right? So can we build it a map? And then map is not enough because other things happened, right? So what things happened? What do we care about? Well, what items did it find? Or was there doors? And then there's keys, and maybe we won't remember that there was a door and there's a key, right? And want it to remember. So it feels like we're kind of running into the same thing. Like we need views, high-level views, right? Something keeping track of what's going on and maybe recording that somewhere. And I maybe want a file or some kind of narration.
I always want to put it in a trace, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, trace will be lovely. So we're kind of discovering that we need this. And it feels extremely applicable to code. Because in code, like what happened, right? What is the current goal that we're trying to do? What are the things we tried? Why did we decide something else? So like all kind of views. And it feels like we need those kind of summarizers to be able to keep up with it.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. Because like I can run the OpenHands agent and I can instrument that and I can get a trace of what did I say? What did it do? What tool did it call? What did it get back from that? But you have a great point. That on top of that, and maybe referencing that actually,
mm-hmm.
a summary trace that's like conceptual that an agent could even go look at the original trace
mm-hmm.
and say, okay, what actually was it doing here? And make an interpretation and a narrative.
Precisely. Yeah. I almost want to write a reprompter like this because I want to be like, I want at any point to kill the context and be able to reprompt immediately without doing it myself.
Right.
So something keeping up with what's going on. And then this is the next thing.
What do you mean reprompt?
So I told AI what to do. I prompted it, right? It does a thing. And something happened here. At some point, if I clean the context completely, if I kill it, I need to start again or I need to continue. How do I continue? So this ability to continue is we are at this point. This is what happened. This is what is needed next. Do that. This is kind of a reprompting, like a continuation of prompt.
Is it like resume in Claude Code?
It's not resume, right? It's like what happens when you resume. So you open a new window, for example, or when you press start. Resume is basically a continuation of the conversation.
Right. It's just pick up where you left off.
Yeah. I'm talking about kill the conversation. start a new one.
Okay.
And you were in the middle of things.
Oh, so like, this is like the write a note for yourself for why did I go downstairs?
Yeah. But I wanted at a fingertip every time. Every time. This is what I was about to do next. This is what is needed next. How do I get this? And I think it's doable. I think you can do it probably with local LLMs.
Ah, okay.
When you said you were having it solve Zork, it just like all... by the way, my favorite thing when I was a kid was to play the text adventure games because that was my age group. So I had all the Infocom adventures. But this is the same thing as saving your game and then coming back and restoring the game from a save point. This is the same concept as like this catch up.
Yes.
You know, do me a favor, catch up for me, checkpoint for me, catch up and move forward.
That's interesting because whenever people say like, if you could have a superpower, what would it be? I always say saving my game.
Yeah.
Because if I could like make a save point right here, go try something, be like, crap, I wish I had gotten up earlier and go back, right? Then I could do so much.
Yes.
If I could actually learn from my mistakes and do something about it.
Yeah.
I love it.
But with our help, the agents have that, right?
Yeah.
We are the administrators of their superpower.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I have several partners about that and several things I use this deliberately, right? Because this is ability to try something. So many people are like, oh, AI is really good at prototyping. And the way they think about prototyping is greenfield.
Mm-hmm.
Completely greenfield, right? The first project.
Yep.
But it's not limited to that. There's several things you can do. Like, for example, the creator of Cloud Code basically describes how he prototyped the to-do list feature. He created 20 prototypes in 2 days. All of them were tested by users. So
wow.
The internal.
Okay, so like live prototypes. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Try all things is what you can do, right? Try everything on a very local, small scale. And now you're so powerful because you're getting knowledge about your domain, about what's good, about what users prefer. Like this is like actually making AI using it for good instead of just crazy producing code that is bad at crazy scale.
And that is a feedback loop that you wouldn't have if you couldn't generate the code super quickly.
That's true. That's true. So, and maybe it's a throwaway code, but that's fine. We learn. We can learn because we can try so many things. It's nuts.
Yeah. The output of the code, the desired result is the learning, not production. Yeah, that like externalization of what I was about to do is something I need to do a lot. And then if you have the AI do it, I guess you like get a save point.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I do as well. So with try everything and so on, right? So one of the crazy things you can do with AI is also you don't know what you don't know and you can quickly get it to tell you what you don't know, right? So just by asking. And also like I really like the idea of seeing all paths. So like instead of taking all paths, you can make it show you all paths. I call it reverse direction. Basically, one way to do this is like it asks you, hey, what technologies do you want to use for this project? And you're like, well, what will you recommend given this task? And it shows you things. And like this is where you start thinking. You don't think at the first step, what technologies do you want? You look at it, what it showed you, and it gives you ideas. And it's kind of the more you see ideas, the more you get ideas. And because AI can generate ideas at a crazy scale and also so much, the breadth, right? It read the whole internet. It doesn't remember the whole internet, but it has a lot of ideas you haven't seen. So you can now show it to yourself and get more ideas.
Nice. And this is in contrast to, you're absolutely right. There's a trick here of not knowing things too early, because as soon as you sound confident, it's going to reinforce that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
absolutely. That's right. It's going to latch into it and yeah. So that's a trap, actually, of like you can answer inject it.
Answer injection. Nice.
Yeah, limiting your answer with your question. I actually see it pretty a lot. I've done it myself more than once.
You see it wedding?
I see people limiting themselves with basically the breadth of output by the way they ask questions.
Mm.
Oh.
Okay.
And you have your instruction in there. Please tell me if I'm like going to make a mistake. And
yeah, but that's not enough in this case because you're like, so one example on Hack for Good, which is like a hackathon that we're at with Llewellyn, Woody, and a few other people who are amazing, wonderful, this summer is, so we're trying to do a process emails from somebody's computer and we don't need anything complicated. But the way somebody prompted it was basically, hey, we need emails from computer. And the answers can be it can be API, it can be server, and it can be something else. Like, guess what answers it gave us, suggestions? API, something and something else. What it didn't give us is the thing we actually ended up using, because I pushed it to say, what thing can be simpler than that? Give me the simplest answer I need to think of. And then it was like, oh, you can just write a local script, and that was enough. And that was actually, like, this kind of stuff is a difference between you getting things done and not. And sometimes in this case, like, we, in 3 days, we solved two of their problems and get them funding.
Wow.
Yeah, that was at Agile 2025, right?
Yeah.
Way back at the beginning, you said something about feedback loops. It was testing. It was about writing the test so that Claude can check its own work. I heard a great quote the other day. It was, ask not what Claude code can generate for you, but what feedback loop you can generate for Claude code.
Yeah.
This was Willem van den Ende.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, we love feedback loops. That's why we're in observability.
Right.
The more ways you can give it to know whether it's succeeding,
yeah,
the more it can do.
Yes.
And the more it can do with less supervision.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I think you're touching upon a thing that's also important. Like, the agent also needs visibility, right? Basically, we're trying to be like, this is a little thing, and you give it a little wish, and you give it everything that it needs for that wish. And if you give it, like, small enough and all the information it needs, or you let it see things, then it does much better than without that.
Observability for the agent and of the agent.
I think your talk was great about the MCPs, right? Where you point out that agents are also suddenly our clients too. And I love that.
Yay. Okay, we need to wrap up. Is there anything that you want to say or point people to?
I guess if you want to learn more about patterns, or if you want to boost yourself in coding with agentic AI, you can watch my talk. Jessica, you'll give a link, right?
Yes.
And there's going to be another one that I just did on AINative.com. There'll be a recording soon, like in a week or so.
Nice.
Yeah, it has a little bit more that I missed in the first version. And you can go to the website or follow me on LinkedIn.
Wonderful.
Great. And we'll link to your LinkedIn, your Lotta Kessler.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, is there anything else we should do before we wrap up?
No, I think that's it. But I just want to thank you, because this is really fascinating. And I think there's great stuff that you have here to mine and learn from. So I know I'll be better at it once I read this stuff and follow along and try some of these techniques, because I tend to do it more intuitively, which is going to burn you every time. You think, I'm just going to vibe with it. Don't vibe with it.
That works after you figure out the patterns.
Right? Yeah, I think you're right.
I think that's also how you learn, right? So what you described about vibe coding, like, that's what I did, right? I had no idea what I'm doing. Like,
it's a journey you're taking, because you haven't talked to a thing like this. I haven't talked to a thing like this since Zork. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
Lotta, thank you so much. It's been great having you.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate the invitation, man.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for today. If you're interested in being a guest on this show, or if you would like to suggest a topic, find us on Twitter at OlliCast. That's OlliCast. OlliCast is brought to you by Heavybit, the leading investor in developer-first startups. To learn more about Heavybit, visit heavybit.com.